Welcome to the Second Society podcast. I'm your host, David Schmidt. It is July 29th, 2021. And tonight I'm joined by a stellar set of guests that should provide you with an extremely interesting roundtable discussion. The topic tonight will be reproduction, the church's duty to get souls on earth en route to guiding them to heaven. My guests are Dr. E. Michael Jones of Culture Wars Notoriety, Professor Brian McCall of the University of Oklahoma and editor of Catholic Family News, and Mr. Tim Kelly, the prolific producer of podcasts, Our Interesting Times, and Powers and Principalities that he co-hosts with Joe Atwell. Welcome, gentlemen. Tonight, I thought we would focus on the situation of reproduction and the need for the church, the Catholic Church in particular, as well as Western society in general, to re-engage with the critical role that reproduction plays in the life of societies, of civilizations, of nations that make them up. And clearly, we've experienced quite an attack, both from the outside and from the inside, on the ability of human beings to reproduce themselves effectively. I became a bit interested in this topic even before I arrived in graduate school at Notre Dame, and I played around with discussions, which I titled Condom Economics. I was a bit provocative back then. Where I wanted to focus on the effect that contraception had not only in the lives of individuals, but then on the economy in general. Later on, around 2001, I was living in Stockholm, Sweden. And in the early days of my living there, I visited a department store, and they had a rather plucky display. This was at the Åhléns department store. And I won't use the word, but they had a glossy trifold next to the cashier's register that said F for the future. And then as you opened it up, it was a admonition for Swedes to begin to reproduce. And of course, the problem with it is it didn't really provide any guidance whatsoever into what should be done. So I think maybe we can start off our discussion. Dr. Jones suggested a little passage from a article by the journalist Russ Duhout that will give us enough diagnosis of the problem, and perhaps then we can take it from there and focus our efforts tonight for the audience on things that we can do that are positive and that can begin to rebuild our church and our society. And that little passage, do you have it with you there, Dr. Jones? And wouldn't you know it, I haven't moved one bit, but I can't seem to put my hands on it here. I just read it to you, didn't I?
I found the article kind of, because Russ Duhout, he's writing for the New York Times. He's kind of one of the conservative guys at the New York Times. He's kind of open to something other than the boilerplate of critical race theory, which runs the entire newspaper at this point. But he's noticing that there is control, that you can't have sex without control. And the question is now, who's going to control it? And how are you going to control it? This was stunning. The other stunning part of this article was the fact that he knew virtually nothing about the recent history of sexuality, largely because he doesn't have the paradigms to deal with it. So the only paradigm that he has is basically ebb and flow. So, you know, sometimes Buddha breathes in and sometimes Buddha breathes out. And that's pretty much the story of sex. Sometimes it's you push for liberation and sometimes you push for control. This is a completely naive simplistic understanding or misunderstanding of what happened in recent history. Just to give you some indication, I was sitting on the porch here in South Bend, Indiana, and I thought, we have about 40 houses on the street. 40 years ago, a little over 40 years ago when we moved here, of that 40 houses, probably three of them were older couples whose family had grown where there were no children. The other 30-some all had children. That situation is reversed now. Three houses on the block have children. The rest do not. Most of them older people, older couples, some of whom have had families, some of whom have not. That is a stunning reversal of the whole fertility situation in South Bend, Indiana. The reason, there are lots of reasons. There are economic reasons because housing is no longer as affordable as it was when I bought the house back then. There are other reasons about simply young people simply not forming families and the reasons for that. None of this comes up in Russ Tutott's article. So the best people they have there are completely clueless, because he can't fathom the idea that sex became an object of social engineering over the course of the 20th century. That is precisely what happened. There's a history of what happened. I wrote this history. It's called Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. I think the facts are pretty clear. And I think if you want to talk about practical results of this type of research, that happened over the course of 2019, when a whole younger generation awoke to a book that probably was written before they were born. The whole discussion of pornography took place on the internet at that time as a prelude to the whole deplatforming discussion. And the people who are in charge of keeping these people under control, the people in charge of using sexual liberation as a form of control, found out about it and started to talk about it. And I'm talking about Rolling Stone magazine, which wrote an article. It was called No Fap November. I think it was a protest against pornography. We're not going to watch pornography for a whole month. It made the news in Rolling Stone magazine, and they accused all these people of doing this of nefarious intentions and ended up calling them anti-Semites, which I thought was interesting because it revealed something about the Jewish role in promoting pornography. So the point here, from the point of view of the church has always understood the importance of sexuality. They've never stopped talking about it. But what they don't understand is the weaponization of sexuality or the reality of social engineering, how it fit in there. Because if they did, they could understand, they could extrapolate from their entry point, which is sexuality as social engineering, into a broader understanding of social engineering. For example, with the way the neighborhoods were destroyed in the 60s, but also it would have direct relevance to today, because now medicine is a form of social engineering. And the church, because they misunderstood never understood social engineering, they don't understand the COVID crisis, and they're not reacting to it properly.
Right. And, you know, Tim, on that note, that quote, I finally found it underneath my chair, is progressives are not quite in the cultural position the Christian church is once occupied in this country, as Michael just mentioned, but they are close enough that the question, how shall we regulate sex, increasingly implicates the whole society. And it raises a question in my mind. When you turn over control of society to people who are fundamentally built on destruction, they become enfants terribles without any real natural end to their work. Can we ask the question, is tyranny order? Is it even order on the route to disorder, or how do we interpret it? And I'm thinking of your podcast this week that you did with Dark Enlightenment, which was excellent, and I think touches on this issue.
Is tyranny order?
Yes.
It can appear as order. I guess it depends how that tyranny is being imposed, but often tyranny is a consequence of a breakdown of the moral order, because in order to be truly free, a man must control his passions. Men must control their passions and be governed by it in accordance with the natural and moral law. And when this breaks down, you create a vacuum, and tyranny fills the void. So that's what this is why now you have things like on college campuses, all types of rules regulating how the sexes should interact, speech codes or getting permission and these things. And in the past, simple manners and morality would have governed that without any friction. Now there's a lot of friction out there because the moral order has collapsed. That type of a political tyranny is a direct consequence of a breakdown of the moral order, because without internal regulations or internal order, logos, if you will, there's no order in society. And we see that in those communities where the moral order has broken down more profoundly, like with blacks in America, with sexual morality, the erosion of the family, and how it expresses itself in violence and these things, street crime, and just a whole breakdown of the community. And now as it's kind of spread out into the wider community, the white population, we see it perhaps at a different pace, but nonetheless just as destructive, because we see the illegitimacy rates, which I think is close to 40% nationally, and I think it's as high as 28% in the white community now, whereas back in 1965, when Moynihan issued his report, that rate was considered disastrous for the black community. It's interesting now that we've surpassed that and we can be just accepted as normal. So we're seeing this imposition of tyranny in our society because of the breakdown of the moral order. That's a wordy way to go about doing it, but saying it, but that's
it's a kind of ersatz or masquerading of order. And probably we've all seen just this week that horrifying video clip of a health official in Australia telling people not to even talk to each other.
Yes.
That this was not a time to be friendly.
Yes.
So that's clearly something. If there's any kind of order being imposed by the police, and of course it's an anarcho-tyrannical order with a kind of fake policing being provided by BLM to enforce some kind of punishment on the greater society, it's not an order that has at its heart a direction towards the divine in any way. Brian, since we're talking about order and law, it's maybe time for you to chime in as the professor of law. What can you say on this topic?
So I think on the part on diagnosing, I think your opening statement captures it a little more fully, and I'll paraphrase. You said it, the problem is about the church should be about getting souls on earth and then getting them to heaven. And I think ultimately that my diagnosis of the problem is a philosophical, which I think most problems are, and it's a loss of the sense of teleology, that everything has an end and that final causes are the most important cause. And sexual relations has become so utterly detached from teleology that I think that's the real root of it. And when we look at it, what is the end of it? It is not just the production of numbers, right? So you point out the problem that even some European countries are admitting, like Sweden, like, wait, we're going to go extinct. So it's not just that we need numbers, but it's about that end of marriage, which isn't just procreation. It's the procreation, rearing, and education of children. And I think when all three of those are disconnected, that's what the problem is. And that's why now it's simply been reduced to atomized individuals, you know, satisfying their passions, as opposed to a whole social movement, which is, again, not just procreation, but the proper rearing and education of children is connected to that.
Right. So maybe now we can, maybe now this is a good point to open up the conversation for you gentlemen to fire away at will, and to leapfrog from what you just said, Brian, maybe we can think about what can we do to, first of all, inculcate in people's minds the idea that the work of life is really, it has to begin with a kingdom building attitude, building God's kingdom, and then to apply it to one's own life. And particularly, let's talk about parents, but not just parents, because the whole community really does, in a sense, participate in the care of the next generations. And so how do we get people to realize that parenting is really a process of productive dying, and things like the American dream and buying boats and waiting to have children until you get your next countertop is not the formula for either a healthy personal life or a healthy civilization. How do we get there?
Well, first, I think, you know, Dr. Jones' point, he mentioned economics are a problem. It is a huge first thing to be addressed about fixing this, because, again, I agree with him completely about this has been social engineered. The economic system is an engineer to make it extremely difficult for this to be done. And again, you cite, Dave, good examples of people who, you know, I want to be able to take 5 vacations a year, so I want to defer having children. But actually, for many people, that's not it. There's no way to survive without both parents working full time, maybe multiple jobs. And so, again, there are some people like that who are just looking for materialistic. But the economic system, since the complete destruction of the idea of the just wage being a family wage, so that, you know, the family would be supported by the wage being paid, so that there could be a proper, family structure to raise children, is something that really, you know, has to be addressed. And it's one thing to say, you know, look, just give up the one job. And for some people, that's possible. I mean, fortunately for our family, we've financially been able to afford that. But that doesn't work for a lot of people who would want to do it. So I think the, you know, inherent injustices in the economic system have to be addressed.
Michael, you wrote extremely well about the destruction of the American city. I recall when I was growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, just in my near area, we had, of course, the parish, multiple parishes. We had a nursing home run by the sisters. There were homes just for the sisters. There were monasteries. There was a high school. There was a college. There was a university. There were savings and loans. There were men's clubs. The kind of reserve institutions and structures that can be there so that parents can begin to take the leap of having more children, and possibly even having the mother at home. Tell us more about that, can you?
Well, as Brian pointed out, in the early 50s, after World War II, when the UAW finally came to an agreement with Ford and then the big three automobile companies, the family wage was part of what everyone believed. Henry Ford believed in the family wage. And what happened is that there was an attack on the family wage through feminism. Feminism, the slogan for feminism was equal pay for equal work. And the Catholic Church should have been able to stand up at that point and say, no, that's wrong, because the man should earn enough so that the wife can stay at home. That's the alternative that you're trying to destroy. Well, what did the church do? The church agonized over sexist language in the liturgy and stuff like that, completely taken in by this subterfuge. That's been the tragedy of this whole situation, where you have the church cheering on the forces that are trying to destroy it. And it's only gotten worse. The church is the vanguard, is the final defense of the moral order. That is the purpose of one of the purposes of the church, is to defend the moral order. And they have been completely unaware of how it's been assaulted. If you don't understand where the attack is, how are you going to have a defense against the attack? That's been the problem. They don't know. Right. They're just not up to speed. Now, you can get by without a Catholic Church. And England is a classic example of that after the Reformation. But in order to do that, you have to have a completely homogeneous culture where custom or manners take over, because you have no metaphysical foundation to defend it. That was the situation in England throughout the period. Let's say there was a collapse of morals after the Reformation. But by the 18th century, with Methodism, you had a return of religious understanding, religious fervor. It was emotional, but better that than nothing. And you had a reform of morals. And that took place in a context where people like Burke would defend manners. Well, manners, he says, are more important than the moral law because the law in general, because this is something that everybody lives on a daily basis, whereas oftentimes you don't have to make contact with the law until you get in trouble. What we had, I remember Tom Case, one of the writers who used to write for us, was not a Catholic growing up, but it was manners that held everything together. There was a certain consensus about what was right and what was wrong that was practical, and it was enforced, and it was all undermined. And as I said before, I've written the history of the undermining of this, people like Kinsey being paid by the Rockefellers, and so on and so forth. That's all been undermined. So the question is, can you go back? Can you go back? And can you go back, who's going to lead you back? There's only one institution that I see that has the moral authority to lead you back, and that's the Catholic Church. And I don't see it happening there. I just don't see that consciousness in anyone in the hierarchy, if we take them as the leaders of the Catholic Church. Just don't see it.
Right. So we have a void that's been created by the clerics in the church, and it looks like we're gonna have to lead, and if we lead, hopefully our shepherds will follow, and it's sad that it has to work this way, but so be it. It's happened this way during the Arian heresy. So you know, and in fact, I remember one of my parishes in California, the vocation director from the San Francisco diocese, and I always used to prod him that what we needed to focus on was marriage and families, and that if we started there, soon enough the vocations would follow. Both in practical terms, of course, you have more people, but also it would generate in people the urgent need for priests, for catechesis, and also a reorientation of the minds of the laity that is getting serious, so to speak, about our the point of our lives, the teleological ends of our lives, and the way in which the child rearing and education play in that progression. Any comments on it? Is that a helpful way to go? It sounds a little counterintuitive, but let's start reproducing and watch how the order begins to return.
No, I agree, Dave. And I will speak as someone with two sons in the seminary and a daughter getting ready to enter a convent. I really think that the lack of vocations, a lot of it is children need to see their parents be generous. I mean, children model their parents. And if the parents are open to God's will completely and say, you know, I'm just going to do whatever I have to do, whatever children God sends me, that's what I'm accepting and working with, that, that is the generosity and the openness to providence that children need to learn that would foster a vocation. You know, they're going to model their parents. Their parents are selfish. And, well, I'm going to limit my family so that I, you know, as I have just one or two children. It's not just the numbers. It's not conducive in an environment to, I think, encourage a vocation.
Yeah, I was after Mass, there was a gathering once at a family's house, and we're sitting around talking, and I was rather new to the parish, and we started talking about this topic of contraception and child rearing. And one of the women asked me in this group setting, she said, well, how many children are we supposed to have? With the implication, you know, that less was better. And I said, well, how about if we use the Holy Family as a model? And so the rule of thumb there would be one more than can be expected. So in other words, you want to try and stretch as much as possible into those areas that otherwise would be filled with consumer goods. Tim, yeah. you have a sizable family. You'd be more of an authority to comment on that than I am.
What? You mean how to get a sizable family? No, but
how to sacrifice material goods?
Well, talking about the shrinking of the American family and the overall demographics, what has brought, you know, the United States and even the West to this point, where it's gonna be eclipsed soon if present trends continue. It goes back to that, the condom economics or contraceptive culture that's sort of been ushered in or imposed on the West for the past century. How did this happen? Well, this is where you have to look at like economics and what was going on in the middle part of the 20th century with social engineering. These are the topics that Dr. Jones has written so much about. It wasn't so much an attack so much on fertility directly, although it was, or an attack on having children. It was the creating of, it was sort of this creation of the contraceptive culture and the values that it imposes or implies. And so people sort of gradually internalize these things. Obviously, various Supreme Court decisions helped. You know, Griswold, you know, Roe v. Wade, you know, Doe v. Bolton, these decisions. But there is the sort of hijacking of the culture, and this wasn't done directly. Like, we're going to hijack the culture. This is the covert warfare that Dr. Jones writes about, that the church appeared to be so oblivious or indifferent to in the middle part of the 20th century in this critical moment. One thing is, a good example is, how do you break up weakened Catholic power? You promote racial integration. What are you, a racist? No, this is one way they broke up the ethnic neighborhoods. And this had a profound effect on the culture and the politics, because it was the dense, highly concentrated ethnic neighborhoods that produced the Catholics' political power. And this, in a sense, for the better part of 30 years, put a short leash on Hollywood. This is the production code. And this was because the production code had teeth because the Catholics, the bishops, had the authority to threaten boycott. This changed in the 1950s and 60s because of integration, the creation of suburbia, which would usher in the 1970s in this contraceptive culture. This coupled with the economic developments that are occurring at the time, the closing of the Goldwater collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the era of debt and inflation and feminism. Not only was it feminism, is you had the decoupling of the economy from reality. And so you had the primary economy, which tended to favor male labor because physical strength mattered a lot. You know, extraction, agriculture, industry, and these things, and the production of sort of the service economy, which produces bureaucracy and pushing papers, and women can do that just as well as men. This also coupled with, again, with the ideology of feminism being pushed, which said, you know, you should go out and earn those bucks, work for the corporation, put off having children, because you can have it all, you can do it all, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to rely on a man. And so what happens eventually, the economy, the macroeconomic reality is it doesn't even support that. So ironically, they talk about choice, but really people don't even have the choice anymore because the macroeconomic the economic reality doesn't support that choice anymore. At the same time, they're pushing the sexual revolution. This produces family dissolution, which increases the rate of trauma, which increases sexual confusion, which then produces more problems or sexual, you know, dysfunctions like homosexuality. Then you have the popular culture, the higher, you know, I guess to the high, the commanding heights of the culture, normalizing this behavior, actually promoting it first in entertainment and comedy, then in schools, then under the pretext of a health crisis like AIDS, and now it's under equality. They've embraced the civil rights paradigm, which is it's about, you know, acceptance and tolerance and freedom and these things. So it was sort of an well, the people that waged this had a very good understanding of human nature and human psychology, and it was manipulated. And, you know, promotion of Alfred Kinsey, the development of the pill, the normalization and promotion of pornography, the Supreme Court decisions that sort of ratified this, that normalized pornography, so you could destroy the police powers. So it was a multifaceted attack on the culture. And unfortunately, the Catholic Church was an institution. I think it had the institutional depth and reach to fight it, but they were caught unawares they were simply blind to the psychological warfare. They got on the, you know, integration kick, and they didn't care that their ethnic neighbors were being destroyed, which is the basis for vocations, and the basis, you know, because if you live in a concentrated ethnic neighborhood, you're going to be surrounded by co-ethnics with the same religion. You're not going to be as subjected to the psychological warfare, or of Madison Avenue or Hollywood. But when you went into suburbia, you just became another white American, and you weren't really an Irish Catholic or German Catholic anymore, or Irish German Catholic, and the Catholicism kind of went by the wayside. So that's when you're talking about fertility. Just telling people to have more babies, yeah, it's a good message, but again, it has to have a context to it. And there's a reason, there's something has happened to the culture of these people, and I think I've kind of explained what happened is why people are actually behaving in a way that's going to lead to their genetic eclipse. But that's why it's called the culture of death, because it's dysgenic. And now that seems to be the norm now. And who's promoting that? And maybe Dr. Jones can talk about that, because the church, why it may still give lip service to Humanae Vitae, the church itself institutionally doesn't seem to be able to take on its enemies, at least engaged enemies, or even acknowledge that it does have enemies in this battle.
Right, and that's a good idea, Michael. So the powers that be that we face here have commandeered these narratives, these ideas, these ideologies regarding ecology and our destruction of the environment. And I know for a fact from inside of academia that things like feminism and homosexuality in the church, all of these things are seen as substitutes for procreation, the way to keep the masses busy while they work away in their cubicles. So midnight trucker show that used to be on. I don't know. I called in and I was talking about my experience in Sweden. And I was thinking about how dutiful and really responsible the Swedes are in so many ways. And yet sexually their morals are gone. You know, I remember standing on a waiting platform in the subway, and across from me is a giant poster of a naked man taking off a condom and dropping it in the toilet. And the admonition, the moral there was, don't put your condoms into the plumbing system. So it led me to think, gosh, so really what Sweden is a giant, very dutiful society, but unhinged when it comes to sex. And so it's like a monastery that has discovered contraceptives. Let's push this further into the realm of what can we do about this? We're getting the idea about what the problem is. How do we yes. push against it?
Yes. It reminds me of a poster that was common in the 1960s. And the heading on the poster said, what to do in case of nuclear attack. And so the step one, close all windows and doors to your room. Step two, crawl under a table. Step three, unbuckle your pants. And step four is kiss your ass goodbye. And I found, I told this to a friend, and he was in charge of the nukes in Germany. They were going to basically prevent the Russians from coming into Germany. And he was in charge of them, and they had that poster hanging there in the headquarters in Germany, where they actually had the nukes. Mm-hmm. So I think that the best solution we have right now is to kiss our ass goodbye. No, wait a minute. No, that's not an uplifting statement here.
Thank
but
you.
I think that the point here is we should deal with this historically, deal with some type of historical. Where are we now? Where do we stand historically? And a good place to look at this would be Notre Dame University. Notre Dame University was instrumental in overturning the consciousness that contraception was a sin. They were the Rockefellers paid Hesburgh to overturn the teaching, you know, and wanted Paul VI to issue a statement saying that it was okay. And Hesburgh arranged a private audience between John D. Rockefeller and Pope Paul VI, where Pope John D. Rockefeller volunteered to write the papal birth control encyclical for him, which is mighty white of him, I thought, being a busy man that he was. But the point here is that they didn't have to. They didn't have to, because what they did is the same thing with the teaching Nostra Aetate, the teaching on the Jews, Dignitatis Humanae, teaching on church and state. Doesn't matter what the document said. They interpret the document and they create the impression that it said the Jews didn't kill Christ, or it says the Catholic Church believes in the separation of church and state, or it says that basically Catholics, it's okay to engage in contraception. Well, that was Notre Dame back then. Well, people back then would say, if you do this, you will have homosexual marriage. And everybody said, that's ridiculous. That will never happen. Why do you? This is crazy. Well, that's Notre Dame is now officially on board promoting Gay Pride Month. They have an official statement saying Notre Dame students should go out and inform themselves about what Gay Pride Month and so on and so forth. Now, what are you supposed to do in a situation like this? You know, what are you supposed to do? And every time I brought this to a bishop's attention, the bishop would blame me. It would be you. What's your problem? This is literally what Bishop Darcy said to me when I did an article on a dead baby found in a trash can at St. Mary's College. What's your problem? I know. Wait a minute. This isn't about me. This is about a dead baby in a trash can. They didn't want to hear it. Nobody wanted to hear it. And so it went from, okay, contraception within marriage to gay marriage and basically the whole homosexual agenda. That has been the trajectory of the past 40 years. So if you asked me in 1965 what to do, that would be different than doing what do you do now? What do you do now? What do you do now when it looks as if the hierarchy is basically an adjunct of the oligarchs, the Jesuits being a good example? I can't think of one oligarchic initiative that the Jesuits don't endorse, from James Martin with gay marriage. Of course, just read America Magazine. It's the whole thing, COVID, you name it, they're doing it. And those are the people who now control the church because the Pope is a Jesuit. And a proof of that is Traditionis Custodes, which is basically came from the mind of Thomas Rees in April, and now it's been imposed on the church. What do you do in a situation like that? I think you crawl under a table and you kiss your ass goodbye. I don't see this is the situation we're in right now. We are in a really serious situation. You can try to get young people the crucial thing that I would tell those young people when I was talking about this and pornography was you're in a crucial situation where you have to form family. This is what you've got to do at this point. You don't have to be a millionaire to do it. But I have to admit that it's much more difficult. I've been married for 53 years. I had 5 children, have 21 grandchildren, and it was easier then than it is now. But that is the crucial thing that they've got to do, in spite of all of the obstacles against them. That's the crucial thing. That's their problem. It's not my problem anymore. It's their problem, and they're going to have to figure out some way to do it at the very minimum, with no support, either from the society or, in general, from the church, in terms of institutions that existed way back when that would support you as part of the neighborhood, as part of the parish, as part of all of these institutions.
Well, Michael, I will counsel you particularly against despair, because what you've done with culture wars is, if that were the only thing you ever did in your life, it would be already a tremendous contribution. So what I wanted to do now is say, okay, on that wonderful foundation or part of the foundation, how can we actually begin to let young people know that we understand the position they're in? Looking at internet discussions about incels over the years, you know, people who've decided to sort of forego lots of sexual activity. I have to say that they are, I'm sure in some cases, but for the most part, an unduly maligned crowd. You know, they're put in a terrible place. Brian, you haven't talked for a few minutes. Let me ask you this. One thing that strikes me, there's so many things that have to be done in order to bootstrap this, and they all have to be done at once. One thing that strikes me is, being a neurobiologist and somebody who's had grazes with electronics and electronics in the laboratory. There's this concept of transmitter channel receiver. This was a classic foundation to information theory. Shannon and Weaver described that in mathematical terms. A lot of people forget that you need to prepare at the same time. You have to have receivers, you have to have channels, and you have to have transmitters. You have to devote effort to all those things. And on the receiver end, I'm thinking, gosh, we need to, I mean, we're trying to get a message out. you folks have done this splendidly, all three of you. And now in terms of preparing the receivers, an idea that pops in my head that I've always liked is the idea of, for instance, houses of study around large influential universities. Opus Dei does it. I know of some Protestants that do it. Is this maybe an option to begin to inform an intellectual class so that they can begin to receive some of these ideas? And these would also be young people who might have the capabilities of effecting changes in their world.
Yes. No, I mean, I think that's what you hit on is you don't want to get overwhelmed with the geopolitical. And again, I agree with all of Dr. Jones' analysis on the social level and everything that's against us. But, you know, if you start at the local levels, and first of all, that's what we talked about with families. And I think the biggest thing is to remind people the virtue of faith. And yes, the forces allied against the church and against the world are enormous and are organized on a level we've never seen before in history. But God will never ask more of us than, you know, we can do. And he will give us whatever grace we need. So if the forces that are doing the social engineering are so great, God will provide the grace to deal with that individually as long as we trust him. And so I think that's what you do, just as I think as Dr. Jones said, just have the family to young people. Just do it. Don't sit sort of worrying about, well, what are we going to do and what's going to happen? And, God will provide. Now, again, he may not provide, a luxurious Bill Gates lifestyle, but he will provide, what you need, and then build on the local level. You know, you started the House of Studies. I'd start earlier. Forget this institution. Start your own schools. Get together with a few, few families. It's simple. Maybe it's in a little portable or, a double wide somewhere. Start your own little school. Even if it's a home, you have to homeschool with a few people collectively. Just start at that local level until eventually, I think, right, houses of study. There's a lot of people doing some interesting things. There's this Alberta Institute, which I don't know if you're familiar with, which is in colleges that they kind of have to go to maybe to make their way somewhat in the system, but really want an actual education. And so using, for as long as we have it, online platforms to do that, to reach more people. So again, house of study, I think that you mentioned is one part of it, but I think the short answer is, be aware of the geopolitical problem because we need to know who we're fighting, but then focus the solution on the local where you are. The social reign of Christ the King is meant to be worldwide, but it starts in individual families and communities.
Right. Tim, along these lines, so now we have young people open to the idea, okay, marry, maybe get a starter house, begin to build that little empire of a homestead. To my way of thinking, from the generation I came, I was born in 1957. Those were the things that I thought would just be a natural part of life. It didn't turn out that way in my case, and in the case of billions, really. But. As a biologist, I think in terms of emergent properties. I mean, it's easy to look around and say, oh, it's really hopeless. Nobody has the idea of what to do. But that's why I think once, as Dr. Jones and Professor McCall has mentioned, once people start having families and then they start to panic, oh, my God. Where are the pediatricians? Where are the school teachers? Where are going to be the high school teachers, the college teachers, or the trade school teacher? Where's the economy going to be? So I think one of the things we can do at our age now is to think about how can we help to build an economy that is ready to receive these people, where enterprise can be an option for an individual so that they can circumvent all of these draconian rules of governance that corporations have taken upon themselves in lieu of government. So, and that really gets us to a critical topic, one that you've all thought and talked about a lot, and that is banking and usury. So what can we do? Again, thinking of this in positive terms, what can we do to begin to build systems of capital for these young folks? And how do we start to build an enterprise culture again? You can think about that for a few seconds.
It shouldn't take you more than a few seconds to come up with a solution to that problem.
Well, I think I one of the things is I kind of alluded to it when I spoke last about what happened to the U.S. economy in the 1970s and 80s, the financialization of the U.S. economy into the 90s. And so perhaps an acknowledgement that we got off track, whether it doesn't seem to be in terms of the policymakers. That's just the vagaries of politics in these things. But we do have to acknowledge the fact that there is an oligarchy, an elite, if you will, that have hijacked, that are manipulating the economy. And their goal, their objective is quite opposite of what you want to achieve, which is being people being able to establish enterprises and small businesses. Well, the last 16 months hasn't been a boon for small businesses, hasn't it? In fact, no. it was that the lockdown was imposed to not to contain a virus, but to destroy what remained of the brick and mortar businesses and the small, maybe mid-sized local businesses that was competing with Walmart and Amazon. So you've had a creation of 500 billionaires in the past year, and a transfer of hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars of wealth, and the further destruction of the middle class. So, I mean, try as you might, unless that regime, the COVID regime, is challenged and overthrown, you're going to have the empire beating down your back the whole time, preventing the very thing from happening. At the same time, creating, publishing, or creating the pornography and the entertainment, the breads and circuses that continue to beguile and confuse the people, so they don't even have the inclination to do what you want to do. That's the problem that we're facing. That isn't to, I don't want to create despair over it, but that's, you can't fight the problem unless you acknowledge the problem. And again, it would be nice if our churches, which particularly the Catholic Church, was an institution that had at least the institutional depth to deal with. It didn't. It sold out, I think. The hierarchy did. And it betrayed everybody. It betrayed the laity when they closed the churches down. And they continue to do it because they don't take on their true enemies. You can love them. You can identify your enemies. You can love your enemies. It doesn't mean you have to deny that you have them. And they're denying that they have them. It's a vexing problem because right now all the institutional powers are dedicated to destroying that renaissance that you're proposing that people work towards. And I don't know how you do that with such an awesome power arrayed against you. You know,
right?
But the important thing is acknowledging it though. Is people, you have to be aware of it first. You have to be aware of what they did to us before you can identify the problem. And the problem I have is I run into so many traditional Catholics who have no idea of how they got where they are. Why are they parish hopping or parish shopping? Good example is this whole Latin Mass controversy. Is a good illustration of how the church simply has no idea what's being done to it, to her, and to society in general, because everyone's focused on the Latin Mass thing, you know. But what about the COVIDian Mass they imposed on everybody, and the regime they imposed on everybody, or the destruction, the disunity that they imposed upon the church in the past 60 years?
One of the things I see as a single, you know, I have maybe a unique, not necessarily enviable, nor one to be emulated, but I have this little bit of a different perspective of having been single for so long and seeing the world of the parish through the eyes of a of a single man. And one of the things I see really is a decline in the quality of the priests. And so the priests are insecure. More often than not, they want to destroy talent as much as possible so they can roll it in a tribal fashion. But again, it's easy to get wrapped around that kind of despair. But maybe the answer, maybe it points us to the direction of what we can do as an answer to all that, which is getting out of the mode of waiting for the priest to tell us what to do, waiting for the church to tell us what to do. Hopefully they'll be good defenders for us once we get back to it. But so maybe getting over this thing of what I like to call malignant obedience, you know, the kind of obedience that just gives over to a church that is thoroughly off course on things like COVID, giving them the power to finally just destroy religious activity in their parishes. So, okay. In other words, let's take the bull by the horns, and as lay people, our particular charism is that of the economy. So,
well, and maybe
with savings and loans and stuff, we can start to rebuild.
And Dave, to follow up there, I mean, what you hit on is really important. So, you know, there are, you know, things that we can do to get it out. I'll tell you the story. There was a friend of my in-laws, a gentleman in his 70s, I think, and his church was closed for all that time. And he kept calling every day saying, when are you going to open the church? And they said, oh, well, the church's not here, you know, this, that. And he said, but you can still send your check in. And he said, church is closed, no check. So number one, stop giving. And number two, and this is really important with the attend, there are good priests out there. There, you know, there are some. We, the lady, we, you know, we can't be priests. What we can do is support them. And so say to those priests, you know, the temporal thing, that's, we got that. That's our thing. We're the lady. We will take care of you. Because again, priests, the good priests get co-opted into the system, sometimes out of fear, even well-intentioned ones, right? Well, what am I going to do? If I kind of put, you know, do the right thing, but will we take care of you? Don't even give it a second thought. So again, there are things that I think we can do to affect that change. If we all shut down and not a single check went into the coffers of those who were destroying the church, and it went to the, and all we did was support the priests who were doing the right thing, that would get some attention.
Right. Okay. Now let's maybe go back to the idea of what are we going to do about our economy? How can we begin to gather capital? How can we begin to wrestle power back from the system? Look, I mean, the Jews in the Middle Ages in the ghettos managed to find a way to do it. How can we do it? We can do it, Michael.
I have reached my limit here. If I open my mouth again, I'm going to say something I regret. So I think I'm just going to thank you all for having me tonight. I enjoyed the discussion, and you know, we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Peace.
Thank you for joining us, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay. Reduced in numbers, but still with some energy, perhaps. Brian, do you want to continue on that? I mean, you've written about usury.
Again, I think, you know, none of us are going to have that lever of power to get rid of the monetary system, put in a real monetary system. I mean, that's obviously not within our purview, but we can do whatever little we can in our local community. So, you know, I live in a little town here in Florida. That right in the center of town, there's not a single chain restaurant. There's a little local grocery store. Yeah, you can get to Walmart and the chain restaurants if you drive a couple miles. But, you know, as far as possible, just don't do it. Go to the local restaurant if you're going to eat out. Go to the local grocery store. And again, this is hard because we are squeezed, as we've talked about, right, by the oligarchy. But yes, it's going to cost a little more. Okay, their prices are a little higher. But, you know, that's the investments that we can make to help each other. So keep supporting as much as you can. Again, maybe it's unavoidable. I'm not saying like you're committing a sin by going to Walmart, right?
Right.
Obviously, sometimes unavoidable, but to the extent it's avoidable, and it said, you know, maybe it causes a little pain. You know, it is a little more inconvenient or it's a little more expensive. You know, we can do that at least on a local level. And again, I'll tell you, the little town here in Florida, I'm impressed. And again, we're a lot better because there were really no lockdowns and it was a free country, unlike the People's Republic of New York. But not a single one of those little local restaurants closed. And the little grocery store in town is renovating and expanding a little bit. So, because, and I have to say, the people of the town did do that. They supported them through this past year. Again, it's a small, tiny little thing in a big place, but the more people that just can do that locally, that's something we can do.
Right. I mean, the savings and loan is, I mean, that was classically our solution for this, right? I mean, we don't absolutely need a Chase Manhattan Bank.
Well, to quote George Bailey, one of my favorite movies, right? This town needs this one horse savings and loan just so they have some place where they can go so they don't have to crawl to Potter, right?
Yeah, Catherine Austin Fitz talks about unplugging from the system and stop supporting the psychopaths. Is you don't have to have a checking account with First American Bank or Chase Manhattan Bank, right, or Citibank, and these are corrupt institutions. They're criminal organizations. And you go to a credit union, local credit union, savings and loan, and that can have a profound effect if a lot of people do that, supporting farmers markets, not complying, just simply not complying with all the irrational, anti-scientific, and immoral regulations they've imposed upon us the past 16 months. Don't get the mRNA shot. Things like that. Don't comply, because they're literally rolling out a plan. Just the other day, I don't particularly care what Don Lemon says. I don't think it's his opinion anyway. He's at CNN, I don't know if, you know, it's a philosophical question. It's just, if someone says someone on CNN, does anyone hear it? Because the ratings are so low. But he says that, you know, if you don't get the shot, you shouldn't be able to go out and go to a supermarket or go to your job. So literally what he's proposing is, you know, the mark of the beast type situation where you can't buy or sell unless you accept, you know, their jab. Don't comply with that. And if people just simply don't comply, they don't have the means to enforce it. Same thing with various lockdowns. And one of the reasons why I think the economy is able to function as well as it did despite the lockdown is people just working anyway, you know, and that's what you have to do. It's, you know, one of the, I guess, one of the high points or one of the positive indicators of the past 30, 40 years is the explosion of the homeschool system. That was largely done in violation of state law, but if so many people started doing it, they couldn't enforce it, and it created its own law because they had to adjust the fact that so many people were doing it, and you're not going to get the oligarchs and their puppet politicians to do what you want to do by voting or by going to protests and appealing to them, but you will do it simply by not complying. And so much of their system does rely on our consent still. So there's still, you have a lot of power if you have the consciousness, if you have the grammar to understand what's going on in the world. And, you know, so that's what's very important, a consciousness of what's really going on in the world, to know what's at stake. And once you know what's going on in the world, you know, it may not keep you out of the unemployment line or keep you out of the bread line or keep you away from the firing squad, but at least when the time comes, you know why you're there, you know? So it's just one of those things where you're right. There isn't going to be a man on a white horse showing up to solve the problems. We're not going to be in a position to design the perfect economic system if that thing even exists, but there are things we can do in the meantime to build local communities, build local economies, live for another day, which we don't take for granted, right?
Right. And, you know, I like to think of that we're in an enviable position. In many ways, this is a time of opportunity. We're coming to the end of an era of what I like to call abject prosperity. And You know, the problem with a time like that, abject prosperity, is that it's so difficult to get people's attention. And it's so difficult to get them mm-hmm. focused on what's really good. And last year, Kevin McDonald came out with a book on individualism and the Western liberal tradition. And he tackles it from the angle of a evolutionary psychologist, and he looks at one of what maybe I'm going to characterize. I don't know that he did, but I'm going to characterize as a flaw of European culture, particularly Northwestern European culture, which is a strong sense of it's me and myself and mine, and we're going to make it. We don't really need anyone else. And those are, I mean, of course, there's a lot of value in sort of picking yourself up and tackling what's ahead of you. But but balance the individualism. It would be good, and I think in this particularly in this time, to think about ways that we can strengthen our interdependence with other people through these mediating institutions like church, or let's not even wait for the church. I mean, let's do those things in the world around us that can begin to nucleate throughout the system a new kind of interconnectedness that isn't dependent upon the old mediated and now controlled systems.
Yeah, I do think that this moment of crisis presents an opportunity, because the regime right now is facing a legitimacy crisis with the COVID. It's actually, that's why it's baring its teeth in a way. This recently, I heard that PayPal was partnering with the Anti-Defamation League to investigate extremism and hate movements on the internet, and they're going to move the cutoff funding. So now you have an outfit like the ADL, which in the past it had kind of worked subtly behind the scenes, and now it's actually being more overt, which is actually puts in a very vulnerable situation, because then people see it, what's going on here. What happened was, the past 15 years with the internet, people started sharing ideas and talking, and they lost control of the narrative. In the past, overt censorship wasn't necessary because they controlled the networks. They controlled the means of communication. So overt censorship wasn't really necessary. In fact, they could actually give lip service to freedom of speech in the service of actually tearing down institutions like the free speech movement. But the moment they came into power, they started using it to censor. And now they're trying to reimpose or impose censorship because of the opportunities that the internet or the technology revolution, the communication revolution, has offered to people, where we can have this conversation, and there can be 10,000 other conversations, and people can publish and get all over the place. But now, when you have a situation like the Biden administration admitting that's partnering with Facebook and Google to censor people, well, now that's admitting that that these private corporations are actually an arm of the government, and the First Amendment does apply to them. And you can't have an administration that's actually openly talking about censorship, which is a violation of the Constitution. So
I think you meant, didn't you mean that the government is an arm of the corporation?
Well, yeah. Which essentially what we're seeing is that corporatism, the corporations are taking over, and they're the governing bodies. But that, again, people have to realize this is a governance issue, where the entire world is faced with this problem, where these corporations appear to be in a position to dictate the governments. And of course, the whole COVID scam is a great example of that, where the oligarchs and their minions at the World Health Organization and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation issued these orders, and not one Western government resisted it, which says a lot about the network of control they've established over the past 40, 50 years, that they're all under their control.
Right.
I agree. There's it is a sign of hope, in the sense, people who would have dismissed thoughts about this or you know, 5 years ago as crazy theories. So that's not, you know, as you said, it's now in your face. You can't just dismiss it as some back smoky room, conspiracy. It's, you know, when the World Economic Forum has a website talking about the Great Reset,
yes,
you can't dismiss it as a theory anymore.
Yeah.
And secondly, you know, a very good priest, you know, recently said, you know, when the devil knows his time is up and he's about to lose is when he makes the most noise,
mm-hmm.
when he shows himself. You know, when things are going his way and he has a lot of time, he's subtle. And again, since we know who all these, the real invisible enemy that all these people work for, the fact that he's so loud and so in your face right now, you know, gives us the hope that I don't know how it's going to happen, but he knows his days are numbered and, you know, something is going to come to change this. Now, again, I don't know what this is, only God's providence does, but I take, you know, hope from the fact that it is so in the open now means, I think, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, I think we're seeing with the attempted to mandate the jab, so-called vaccine. Again, not a vaccine. It's a messenger RNA therapy drug, experimental, which by very nature causes a autoimmune reaction. But they falsely marketing it as a vaccine. But at first, they tried to cajole and bribe with free donuts and free hamburgers and lottery tickets and tickets to Six Flags or Disney World. That didn't work. And just recently, I saw a thing with Mayor de Blasio in New York saying, yeah, we tried it voluntarily. It didn't work. Now we're making it mandatory. What is it about voluntary? Don't you understand?
Yeah. That's
like, what? I mean, so it never was voluntary then, you know,
right.
But it's such an audacious claim of power that it's waking a lot of people up. And now they've hit the brick wall. This, right, we think we're a solid 40-50% aren't going to do it. So what do you do at that point? You know, and again, it's chutzpah, it's hubris, and it does present an opportunity because now you're saying, look what they're trying to make you do. Look what they've done. You know, something's obviously very wrong, and the way you thought the world worked for your entire life isn't really the way the world works. So now here they are. Here's the problem. What's to be done? And that's the moment of opportunity that perhaps God has allowed for us, because God has a way of making his enemies destroy themselves. Just, you know, and this is the cutting of reason, which Dr. Jones often writes about, you know, quoting Hegel. So it does. I mean, this problem existed 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 2 years ago. So, you know, but now, since with the COVID cult and the stuff, it's exposed so much that it a lot more people have woken up to the reality. If not woken up, they're at least stirred a little bit, you know. So, you know, I wish you could sit down, have a rational conversation with people, and say, before it gets too bad, let's do this. But unfortunately, things have to get bad. You know, that's just the way it is. That's just, you know, if you read history, that's the way it is. You know,
to make sure that we catch up on and anything else that you two want to finish with. One is, when I went to live for 3 years in Europe or Scandinavia, however you categorize those things, I discovered something was more or less right between me and that society. And I kind of wish that Michael was here, maybe. But I certainly do believe in the existence of what I call a neuroculture. You know, so in other words, there is confluence between our brains, or the way our brains work, the way our minds work, and also the external culture in which we live. And there's important feedback. So my personal position is that there's a strong case to be made for not some kind of draconian and hermetically sealed society without any migration, but there is a strong case to be made for those rather homogeneous cultures. Even in a place like Pittsburgh, which was filled with all kinds of different ethnicities, they had their own own parishes, and for many years the city father, so to speak, seemed to navigate well the idea of being different and yet somehow all being Pittsburghers. So I'm wondering if maybe ethnicity might be a very good way of rejuvenating senses of loyalties and cooperativity that go beyond the selfish self. And of course, it can overlap with other things, as it should. Like, I'm Catholic, you two are Catholic, Michael's Catholic. We have different identities, we have national identities. They try to tell us that those are divisive things. But I see them as like chemical bonds between atoms. And you can have bonds between atoms in different groups of the molecule. So that, you know, the idea of divisiveness is itself propagandistic. How about you two weigh in on the possibility, the hopeful possibility, that we can rediscover ethnicity and also border? I also like to think of borders as a channel for communication, not as a wall, but a protective communication.
Yeah, I mean, to your first point, Dave, I, having lived in Europe twice, once in the early 90s and once in the early 2000s, I understand what you're pointing to because I sensed it there. There was still a sense of, you know, we have a common history. We are, and again, we as Americans sort of stood outside of it looking at it. But, and I think it's something Europe had on America, you know, from the beginning, because we were near the beginning. We sort of didn't have that same sense, being kind of an artificially created country and one that then, particularly after the beginning, you know, became this sort of patchwork. But I think the problem is, I think it's gone. I mean, I think the oligarchs have, you know, done mass migrations in and around Europe that they've really destroyed what I saw in the early 90s and early 2000s. I saw it disappearing in the early 2000s, but it was back in Europe the summer of 2019 teaching there. And I think the sense that you described that I saw wasn't there anymore. Now, again, it's there, I think, in pockets and some rural parts. But I mean, it was even in London when I was there in the early 90s. Still a cosmopolitan city, but there still was the kind of English history, English culture that dominated. And that, I don't know how you put that genie back in the bottle. Right? Once the egg scrambled, I mean, I agree with you that it would be a good thing, but I'm not sure, particularly in Europe, if that's and it's interesting because the only cohesive ethnic culture that's really there right now is the Chinese. And you can see your point. I think the power that does bring is pretty strong. Now, they've got a corrupted version of it, obviously. But so I don't know. I'm not as hopeful as you are on that front. I'm not sure.
Well, Tim, so the biologist in me wants to. The biologist in me sees all kind of possibilities for emergent properties, and you know, there the idea is that with a water molecule, if you looked at a water molecule, an oxygen and two hydrogens, and if that's all you could see, if that's all you knew, you would never predict something like wetness. Okay, so there, and the same thing in biological systems. You know, you have maybe in petri plates, let's say 10 different species of bacteria. You look at each one of them under a microscope, and let's say they're all rod shape. You can't distinguish them. They don't have color at that kind of magnification. But when you look at them in a petri plate, when they grow, you see one produces a blue colony, one produces a yellow colony, one produces another colony that has smooth edges, another has rough edges, one smells bad, one doesn't smell so bad at all. So there are properties that emerge from what at a lower level look like rod-shaped bacteria. Put them together and interesting things come out of it. I'm wondering if it maybe in this period of stress, essentially, what might occur, and we Catholics would interpret it as a miracle, would be the emergence of some surprisingly organizing things that, I mean, just like I read this guy, I wasn't an ardent member of the Teutonic Club, you know, marching around with a furry hat and horns or anything. Somehow my Germanic thing kind of came out by going there. I'm wondering, maybe there's some hopefulness in what I want to call emergence.
Well, I mean, certainly a new order can emerge and it could be unintended. You know, I don't think when, you know, the Germanic, barbarians sacked Rome that they intended to create Europe and Christendom, but that's what occurred. So right. Out of this, you can have, you know, there are unforeseen events or results of some of these plans. And one thing I do think is what they're doing, recently they've, with a lot of the weaponized migration, I think they might have created sort of a unforeseen ethnic or racial solidarity, particularly, with white people in the United States. There's sort of this, this upsurge in anti-white rhetoric, almost to the point where it's almost cartoonish. You know, right. So then you have this whole thing, this whole nonsense of white supremacy being a problem. When I really don't see any evidence of white supremacy.
Right.
You know, it's like, if it existed, we wouldn't be hearing about it.
I'm in the most red of the red Bible Belt states in the country, which would make it the most conservative polity in the world, I think, Oklahoma. And I'll tell you, I mean, where are they? Where are those white supremacists?
Yes,
I don't see them.
Yeah, but it's all theater, political theater. We've had the charade of these hearings on the January 6th insurrection, they're calling it. And if you just watch a few minutes of it, they're a joke. And they're transparently, it's a transparent charade. Anyone who's watching these things. And it's hard to say. I mean, it's one of these things where I think the regime has gone so far down a limb on this that it does present these opportunities. So you're gonna have emerging situations, emerging arrangements as people deal with the crisis. And I do think at some point you're gonna have probably a sort of a disintegration, because what they're doing with the immigration, pouring in people from all over the world into the United States and trying to do this in Europe too, is the country's really disintegrating itself. It was bound together by a certain creator idea, but those creator ideas were largely upheld by its founding stock or its core ethnic group, which they're at war with now. And so these ideas that define America are no longer really even supported by America, like free speech or freedom of religion or right to bear arms, the Constitution, these sort of the proposition nation that they say America is. And it turns out that, it's the proposition nation, but the propositions are only really held here near and dear by the ethnic whites of the country. And we're told this because we were told how the browning of America is going to result in a sudden shift in the country's, or a gradual shift in the country's politics and culture. And these things. So we're being told that there's ethnic warfare being waged against us, but if you acknowledge it, you're a racist. You know, it's one of these things. It's a double bind for a lot of people. But again, people are going to respond dynamically to this, and they're going to start to maybe develop a consciousness or an idea from which you can build something on politically. At the same time, it also sets people up to be characterized in a way that we see now, where any assertion of ethnic white interest is construed or characterized as hate or white supremacy, when it's a natural result of the very things that the regime is throwing at them, you know.
Right. Well, so again, I having really followed the left and even sort of in my near the end of my college days, becoming a little bit lefty, seeing it all from the inside, and even just, you know, simple acts like listening to National Public Radio, you know, when you're in the car, however much of it you can tolerate, you really see how these people constantly make lemonade from lemons. I mean, they don't believe in defeat. They turn everything into an opportunity, and they are masterful at realizing that everything is about re-narrating whatever happened according to your plan. And I think that's something that we don't do well.
But we don't have support of all major corporations and government. And
right.
So that's the difference.
We need to make it ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, you're doing in your podcast.
Yeah. But I'm saying is the left portrays itself as being anti-establishment, going against the man, when they're supported by it. Just a good example, Black Lives Matter or the civil rights protests that had support of the system. That's why it succeeded. That's why if you're like a pro-life group, you can't invoke civil rights and civil disobedience except to be treated the same way that, say, that the civil rights movement was treated, because that had the favor of the oligarchs, whereas the pro-life movement doesn't have the favor of oligarchs. So that's the rules we're playing under. A good example is down in Charlottesville. They could go down there and protest the name of free speech. They had a permit. They were simply protesting the removal of statues, but they were set upon by Antifa, and the police let it happen. The city government let it happen. But then it was portrayed in the media as if they're the ones marching on the city. Again, they thought they had a right to free speech. They don't. You don't have the right to free speech.
And, you know, by the way,
it's not acknowledged by the government.
Yeah. I just did a podcast that, at the prompting of Joe Atwell, by the way, he said, well, you find a way to reach the Australians. And he's always prompting me to make use of the Catholic thing. So I made a podcast called Dear Australians, you know, and basically what I tried to do was take advantage of whoever's Catholic down there, take advantage of what we can do as Catholics, not to go down with tiki torches, say, but rather to gradually come out of our houses with rosary crusades or whatever. I mean, there's ways that we can push the envelope.
Well, that worked in St.
Louis. We won't get arrested. But,
yeah, that worked in St. Louis. It saved the St. Louis mansion. I mean, statue. St. Louis, and they were... First, they were portrayed as white supremacists. They were Catholics who were protesting removal of the statue, the namesake for the city, you know, the patron saint of the city. And so that's a good example. That's a position that's hard to attack, because religious freedom, whereas, you know, essentially white identity has no protection in law in the United States. It's actually, because the civil rights actually protects special protected classes, and whites aren't among them, particularly white males. That's the way the current regime treats the law. That's just the reality of the situation. It's harder to go after a particular religion. And so when they identify as Catholics, they prevailed. And maybe there's a lesson there.
Brian, you and I have talked before. In fact, we were both at a conference where I presented something on the mind brain problem, as they call it in philosophy, related to that, but something that comes to my mind as a tool or an advantage, let's say, that we Catholics have and that we can offer the world is a true understanding of contemplation, both as the teleological goal of our life in heaven, the beatific vision, but also the way that contemplation can work in this world. And so many of these problems that have been set up by the oligarchs, essentially the consumerism, the Hollywoodism that Tim mentioned earlier, all of these things that are cracks, by which the manipulators, the mind controllers, the MK Ultra types, the way that they get into our lives, that our big, one of our big immune psychological or spiritual immune responses to that is our capacity for contemplation. And I'm wondering if perhaps this might not be a vastly overlooked opportunity that we Catholics have for reestablishing a real new world order, the kingdom, the a life that is in accordance with the Logos.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I agree. I mean, I think we, you know, they can take the economic system, they can take, you know, everything on the material level, but, you know, we still are the master of our soul. And again, even if, you know, the truth just lives in us, even if we get to a point where we're completely constrained in terms of Catholic action, and again, we're not there now, I think we need to try to do things, but if we still maintain and, you know, tradidi et quod et accepi, hand on what we've received to our children, you know, ultimately we win. So, yes, I think ideas are important. That's why it's important to have podcasts like this and to talk about these things. You know, a lot of people say, why did you write this book about usury and about, you know, all these principles? They'll never be implemented in our day. And I agree with that. But if we stop contemplating the true principles, even if we can't find a way to put them into action right now, then they have one. So yes, and I think that's part of what our job is. I mean, it's sort of the monks in the medieval monasteries who preserved the texts. In a certain sense, that's one of the things we have to do now, is preserve the truth and preserve the ideas until a later time. And that's through continuing to contemplate them.
Right. Remind people that there is a North Pole.
Yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I was listening to an interview of a priest who wrote a book about integralism and the confessional state and how it applies today. And he had someone asked him about what's the practical, chances of this ever being applied and what's the use of it. And his response was, well, it's a book about philosophy. You know, he's just making a point. Let's think about this, and that's the first step. Is thought has to precede action. And so that's an important point. Yes. And right. Yeah. And that's
a great book. Father Crean and Alan Finister's book.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. I just reviewed that. It's an excellent, excellent book.
Yeah. Cause I'm thinking about these things as you look at sort of as the American system sort of collapses on itself, reaches the reduction ad absurdum of it all, liberalism. They look at these ideas and, you know, and yeah, it's, this is, the idea of an integral state with an idea with the divine law at the head guiding everything. And we see now we're just resorting to like bills of, you know, paper parchment promises of rights and relying on politicians, and in the absence of God, they become God. You know, that's why you have these decrees and these orders that they can make you do, like get a shot or something against your will. So.
Yeah. I preparing for those talks I was giving in 2013, Brian, I learned about this Greek concept of phronesis, or at least I learned the word for it. The joining of thought and action. Yes. And so we can close on that. And I certainly want to thank both of you for a lengthy discussion. I thank too Dr. E. Michael Jones. Forgive me for all my technological stumbling early on. And personally, I think that what you three did was to lay a good foundation for future discussions as we move from theory now to action.
Thank you for organizing it, Dave.
You bet.
Thank you.
You bet. Have a good night, gentlemen.